So how well do you know your family history? We'll get a lesson in finding out how to find out more this hour. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, October 1st. Our interest in the topic was piqued by a webinar course in genealogy that the Wisconsin Historical Society held last week. And then we discovered there are a number of classes and workshops starting this month and lasting through the end of the year that you can take part in. So we thought we'd get a primer on how to trace our family history this hour and welcome your questions and your experiences if you're already doing this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And we have provided a link on our Facebook page of the classes that are taking place this month, starting this month, from the Wisconsin Historical Society. Our guest is Jim Hansen, a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how long have you been at this?
About 40 years.
Yeah, and it's always been you're a specialist in genealogy.
That was my specialty. I've obviously at the Historical Society had to do a variety of other things as well, but genealogy is really at the heart of it all.
Yeah, so why were you so fascinated in genealogy?
Just a basic curiosity, like most people, I think. And I started by asking family members, my parents, some aunts and uncles, for information, and actually wrote it down, which is kind of the starting point of all of this sort of thing, is to get down in some organized fashion what you already know so that you can figure out what you're trying to go to from there.
That's that's really basic advice, but smart advice. A lot of family discussions and conversations in our family anyway about the family tree, but no one's written it down.
That's often one of the first barriers to, because every time some member of the family passes, think of the times that you've been at a funeral, for example, and family discussions like this come up, and how many of those questions could the subject of the funeral have answered.
Right.
No matter when you start asking these questions and writing them down, you didn't start soon enough.
Yeah.
There was always somebody that if you'd asked 5 years ago, you could have gotten lots of information that is just essentially gone.
So that's probably another good thing to do is ask somebody who's living right now.
Do as much of that as you can. A lot of the resources that we end up using in the research process are going to be available in a year, 5 years, 10 years, and they may even be online in a year, 5 years, 10 years. But Grandma may not, or Aunt Harriet, and all of those other people who not only may know a great deal, but may have their own records that relate to this. We talk in traditional terms of the family Bible and that kind of thing. But it may be a collection of clipped obituaries from the newspapers. It may be Grandpa's naturalization record. It may be just about anything that is all pulled together related to the family, so you don't have to pick it out of the giant mass of information that's out there in all sorts of strange places.
So you said you had a natural curiosity, and I suppose that's what drives a lot of people to trace their family history. But why is it that it's so important to some of us to know that to know our family tree?
I think it's a fairly basic human nature. There are, after all, genealogies in the Bible. There are genealogies in the early literature of many ethnic groups, many nationalities. It's just wanting to figure out what our place is, how we got to that place, and to, I think, remember some of the people that are the reason we're here.
So how far back have you traced your family history?
Well, some branches I've got back into the 1700s, 1800s. Some I've got back into the 1500s, 1600s. I've had pretty good success over the roughly 40 years I've been doing this. And
it varies
from branch to branch. And no matter how far back you go in a particular branch, there's always two parents that person had that you haven't found yet. So it's just an endlessly expanding
What were some of the roadblocks that you encountered?
Well, the usual roadblocks, I think. Most of them, or about half of my families had been in North America for since the 1600s. My father's father and my mother's mother's family were 19th century immigrants, one from Norway, one from Germany. And it took quite a while to make those connections back into the old country, just because I didn't have enough information to do it. But it was eventually successful, and have traced them back in, to some degree in their original countries of origin.
I mentioned to you before we went on the air that I am first generation on my dad's side, and I would have to go back to the old country records to find the family history. Is that going to be easily done?
It varies from country to country, depending on how good the record-keeping tradition is in that country. Your family, I believe, is from Italy. Their records are pretty good. If you can identify the village, the community that they were living in, there's a good chance of civil records and even better chance of church records going back into probably the 17th century. The difficulty we have, we think of our immigrant ancestors of having been from the the primordial village almost, where they had been for generations before that. But in many cases, they were just as mobile in the old country as they've been in this country.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the people who were not landowners, who were basically peasants, peasant farmers, tradesmen, etc. They're the ones who immigrate, and they're the ones who are the most difficult to trace.
One of the classes that you'll be teaching coming up later this month is immigration and genealogy?
Tracing your ancestors in immigration records. The one of the big challenges, and it's one of those things that people find particularly interesting, the immigration experience and the records that it creates, partly because there's always the hope that it'll give you the clue as to what that ancestral village may have been. A lot of times the records in this country simply don't give you that information. Finding those records is a particular challenge. Many of them are being created by people who don't understand your ancestors, literally. They don't understand, they don't recognize the language, they don't know how to spell the names, even if there was a correct spelling, which there often wasn't. If your ancestor wasn't literate, how is your ancestor going to know how to spell that name?
Right.
So that the records are particularly challenging, and there are lots of lots of ways to try and attack that particular problem, and that's what we'll be talking about in the session.
And that session, again, is on the list that's posted on our Facebook page, but the date for that
November 10th.
November 10th. Yep. So we are getting a primer this hour on how to trace our family history. We are previewing some of the courses and workshops that you can take with the Wisconsin Historical Society starting this month and lasting throughout the rest of the year. And we're welcoming your questions for our guest expert, Jim Hansen, a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Are you interested in genealogy? Why? What interesting tidbits have you discovered about your family's past? We hope you'll call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Checking our weather forecast for today, it's going to be partly cloudy with highs near 70 degrees, becoming partly cloudy tonight with lows in the mid 40s, and tomorrow a clear day with highs once again in the low 70s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about tracing our family history this hour with Jim Hansen, a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. The Wisconsin Historical Society is beginning genealogy classes and workshops this month, and they will last through the end of the year. What questions do you have about tracing your family history? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And we would be interested in some of your exciting discoveries or any problems that you have run into as you try to plot your family tree. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. It is now 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, October the 1st. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, it's the first day of our fall pledge drive. Don't groan. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a lot of great topics, a lot of interesting conversations, and a number of wonderful thank you gifts for your pledges of support. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the Wisconsin Local Foods Journal. And we will have a 2013 Wisconsin Local Foods Journal as our thank you gift. We're going to be talking about seasonal foods and local foods and what to do with them when. And this thank you gift is something that you might be able to plot your plans with local foods. And that's tomorrow at this time. Right now, we are getting a lesson in how to trace our family history with Jim Hansen. And we have calls coming in, Jim Hansen, but you mentioned that the first thing we should do is write it down. You know, write down these family stories. Write down what we know so far. Then what?
Then it's time to start doing some research to start filling in the holes. One of the really good places to start is with the newly released 1940s U.S. Census.
Okay.
To trace, you know, your parents or, depending on how old you are, perhaps yourself, and find out what that census can tell you, where they were living. It gives you additional information on age, occupation, state or country of birth, and you can start doing that. The census is available for free on the commercial website Ancestry.com and also on FamilySearch.org, the LDS website. Those are two of the major products that are out there now with a whole range of resources available. It's not a bad idea to just do some basic research, just Googling the some of the names that you're working with and locations. It's often helpful to one of the things that is often surprising is you think of a particular name as fairly uncommon, and then you start doing a little research and discover that it's a lot more common than you thought. Even the combination of a first name and a last name can be, and if you're looking for, you know, John Johnson or Henry Smith or something like that.
Yeah, then it's harder, I bet.
Then it's even more critical to have other factors involved when you're doing in the search.
Well, we have calls, and I'm sure we can continue along these lines as we move along. Wayne in Rockland is with us. Hello, Wayne.
Hello.
Yes, and your question?
Yeah, what do you do with all the divorces and that, and all the adoptions that are going on now? How do you trace through that?
Divorces are a fairly common thing, and they've been more common in older times than we think. Divorce records are usually public records, at least as much as any records are public, and they're often worth tracking, keeping in mind that the information in the allegations in a divorce proceedings may be expanded just to for their purpose. Anytime you're dealing with a record that has a purpose like that, you have to be careful about the information. But a divorce record can identify, among other things, the date and place of marriage, which can be very critical. Adoptions are more of a problem. And in more present in the times like the 20th and 21st century, adoption records are generally sealed records, permanently sealed records, and you often have to work very hard to get around those basic problems. I think of adoptions as more missing persons than genealogy in many respects. It's all because the whole body of record has in many cases been changed to reflect the altered reality, shall we say.
More adoptions are open today than they used to be, though, right?
Oh, indeed. And a lot of times, in earlier times, in the 19th and early 20th century, there were a lot more informal adoptions. One of the parents dies, disappears, whatever, and you know, basically the neighborhood takes over. One of the kids is taken in by the wife's sister and her family and things like that. And those kind can be very difficult.
Yeah. So do you give up if there was an adoption way back when?
I wouldn't give up, but I would certainly keep in mind the possibility that there simply may not be records to get you past that problem. But there are things that you can do, certainly looking at the older census records, looking for church records of baptism, for example, that may give you more detail than the civil records. And once you get back before 1900, even the civil records may not exist. Registration of births, marriages, deaths, etc. was the exception, not the rule, when you get back that far.
We did a program on adoption last week, and our guest expert was just mentioned that he likes the terminology plotting your, instead of family tree, your family orchard. So I don't meaning that there are many different trees.
Indeed.
Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hello, Diane.
Good morning. I have a question. I'm doing some family research right now, which has been extremely exciting. My grandmother came from northern Minnesota and ended up down here in Milwaukee after marrying my grandfather, who's a pharmacist. And we're looking at all the different siblings and trying to figure out where people ended up. And my grandmother had a brother who died from tuberculosis, and what I've been trying to figure out is where he went, what sanatorium he went to. And it also turned out that my grandmother's father died from tuberculosis as well, and family lore has it they all remember waving goodbye to him as he got on a train to a sanatorium, and they believe it was in Minnesota, but they think it also could have been in Wisconsin. So the thing is, how do I do some more tracing in that regard?
I think your best bet here is not to look specifically for a sanatorium, but rather for a death certificate. A death certificate in either Minnesota or Wisconsin is filed at the state level. And so there are statewide records. And in fact, for Minnesota, the death indexes are available online through the Minnesota Historical Society. For Wisconsin, they're not. You'd have to write to the Wisconsin Vital Records Department to get a death certificate. But the death certificate would obviously identify the place of death as well as the place of burial. And once you know that, that'll improve the chances of finding the sanatorium if that's what's needed.
Good luck to you, Diane. Thank you for calling. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jim Hansen, a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. We're talking about learning about our family history and how to trace our family history. Jerry in Appleton is with us next. Hello, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. I thought this was pretty interesting. On my husband's side, his family has been researching his last name and doing their genealogy for years. But they found out, just some of the snags you could run into, they found out that at Ellis Island, they were from the Ukraine, when there was a language barrier, and when they asked their last name, they just gave the city that they were from. And in Ukraine, the last name is Kolchecki, but in Ukraine, Kol means from, and the city was Chesky. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing this right. But probably due to some frustration there, they wound up with the last name of Kolchecki, which was not their last name at all. It was Rushka.
Uh-huh. So did they what happened?
The story of how they found out this is just as interesting, but twice as long. It has to do with an archbishop that she knew, and it goes back. But there was another person, too, that she did also locate, Peter Kolchecki, that she could not associate with anybody, you know, relatives in the family. And the same thing had happened to him, as it turned out.
What I'm curious about, Jerry, is did this family keep the mistake of a last name, or
right?
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yes. So my husband's an alias.
That is interesting. And we were talking about this too, Jim. My grandfather had a wrong first name at Ellis Island taken down, probably through the language barrier. And his name was Primo, but the Ellis Island people wrote down Bruno. So that happened quite a bit.
Well, there were certainly errors in any records, and any time you're dealing with language barriers and all of the other difficulties, the same thing happens in census records. You'll find all sorts of variability. The key here is that the record at Ellis Island had no official standing. It did not create the name.
Yeah.
That the family decided to take that name, they, for whatever the reason, etc. How it happened to be recorded at Ellis Island was essentially accidental. Most names were changed over time as they became gradually Americanized, or yeah. You know, people with multiple Norwegian or Scandinavian names settled on one and stuck with it. Those kinds of changes took place all the time.
But that would, I guess, provide somewhat of an issue for people trying to trace a family history if Kolchecki is the name in this country, but it wasn't the name in the old country.
And it's not uncommon for the names to have changed in the process of immigration or the years, the generation following.
We will continue taking your questions about how to trace your family history, some of your interesting finds, some of the roadblocks you've encountered. Our guest will try to help you sort through it all. Jim Hansen is a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. The Wisconsin Historical Society is beginning genealogy classes and workshops this month, and they will last through the end of the year. You can check out a list of the classes on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll check news, and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network.
Blood's thicker than mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
We are talking about our families and tracing our family history. The Wisconsin Historical Society is holding genealogy classes starting this month and lasting through the end of the year, and we are getting a primer course this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 6:36 on this Monday, October 1st. Our guest is Jim Hansen, who is a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He is an expert in genealogy, and we are welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'd be interested in knowing some of the discoveries you have made or some of the roadblocks that you have encountered. So let us know. Jason in Watertown is with us next. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. My question, actually, I have a question and a statement. My question is, I have a roadblock about I found my great-great-grandparents in a shipping manifest coming from Germany to the States, but it says their point of origin was Prussia. Well, Prussia back then was rather big. So I don't exactly know where to go from there to try to narrow that down. And my statement about the name-changing thing, that's still even fairly recent because when my dad was born, his last name is Teel, and it's spelled T-E-E-L. But when he joined the military, for whatever reason, the military added another E at the end. And to this day, I still carry that E.
Yeah. Well, that happens too.
Those kinds of changes happen a lot. Certainly, military service seems to have been an important factor in name fossilization, for lack of a better term. once you got shown, appeared in under a certain form in a military record, even back in, during the Civil War, you tended to stay with that because that tied, you know, from record to record within the military. And then if you went back, you know, 30 years later to apply for a pension, for example, getting that name spelled the same way was important for getting your service verified and getting to the pension.
And what about Prussia, which it doesn't exist?
Prussia, and this is a fairly common problem, Prussia was often simply a synonym for Germany. So in this case, the passenger list simply doesn't provide enough information to make the leap to the old country, which is not uncommon. A lot of records like that simply say, give the country rather than a specific place of origin. It means that you have to spend even more time and energy and money, as the case may be, in tracking records in this country relating that may give you a clue as to where the family was in the old country.
When you say money, how much does is this a costly hobby?
Well, it's one of those hobbies that can be as costly as you want to allow it to be. excuse me. If you subscribe to one of the online services, for example, for a year, that'll cost you several hundred dollars probably. Getting a marriage or death certificate from a courthouse or state vital records office probably going to cost you $20 a record or thereabouts. It varies from state to state, and I think from minute to minute. But all of those kinds of things come into play. But you're often doing this over a period of time, and you can, especially if you have a family working on it, you can share some of the expense.
Everybody chip in.
And if you take a vacation to go to a courthouse someplace or, you know, a resource repository, you know, is that really a genealogy expense, or is that just, you know, your vacation expense for that year?
So, and it does cost if you want to be a part of like this Ancestry.com, these websites that are...
Ancestry is certainly the con ed, if you will, of the genealogy field. However, many libraries have subscriptions to the what they market as the library version. Virtually every library, certainly in the southern part of the state, and a fair number, I think, in elsewhere, have subscriptions. But you have to go to the library to use it. And there are other resources. There, the FamilySearch.org is a free site. And they have a wide range of records, including some of the federal census records, which are so critical in tracing American genealogy.
That census that you mentioned, the 1940 census, is that available for free if you just look up?
1940 is available for free on FamilySearch. It is also presently available for free on Ancestry as well, as an introductory sort of thing. They've made it free for the first year. It became available in April of this year, and for this 12-month period, Ancestry has made it available free on their site as well.
And what resources do you have at the Wisconsin Historical Society?
We have subscriptions to the various major websites. We also have a tremendous book collection, family histories, local histories. If your ancestor got written up in a history of a county in Indiana in the 1880s, we probably have it. Or just about any other part of the U.S. and Canada. I found some records relating to a distant branch of my family in a history of a town in Saskatchewan that was published in the 1960s. And it turned out we had a copy at the Historical Society. So there's a tremendous amount of information there, and we like to think a modest amount of expertise as well.
Jim Hansen is our guest, a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's with us for another 6 or 7 minutes or so. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for him. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And again, we have provided a link to the classes that the Wisconsin Historical Society is starting this month on genealogy and tracing your family history. And you wanted to note one of the classes, Jim Henson, is on writing your family history. That's where we're supposed to start, isn't it?
Well, it's getting it written down is the starting point, but it's also the end point. For most of us, our goal is to write something that we can share with other family members. And many of us find that research part so fascinating and so potentially endless that we never quite get around to pulling it together and making a product available for our kin. And that's what this presentation is on December 15th, and it's not taught by me because I'm a chief offender in that regard. About how to get it organized, how to get it written down, or to get it in some fashion that you can then share. And obviously today, the possibilities, it doesn't have to be a book. It can be a document that you can email to your other family members or whoever you want to send it to, so that it's just opened up all sorts of possibilities.
I see that one of the classes, too, one of the first ones, I believe, is organizing family photographs. And I now with Facebook and the computer and all the photographs that I know a lot of family members have scanned old photos in there, it'd be great to try to organize all of those photos.
And
into
that's the purpose of this particular presentation. And it's, we've given this one before. Obviously, it's a changing target.
Right.
And for that reason, it's particularly effective at this time because there are so many possibilities, and this will talk about the various ways that it can be done, and also, as any good presentation, tell you the things to watch out for and avoid.
Oh, I should take that course, is what I should do. Jerry on Facebook says, I could talk for hours about gathering family history. What I started as a family cookbook has turned into a family cookbook and history. Started gathering family recipes, started to add some family stories, and added and added and added. I started this project about 6 years ago. My small project has turned into a book with over 400 pages of family recipes, family trees, stories, and hundreds of family photos. Perfect. Doesn't that sound wonderful?
That's exactly the kind of thing that is worth sharing with family members. Because if you don't do it, who's going to? And that stuff is just going to get lost.
Thank you, Jerry. What a great idea. I should hire Jerry to do mine. John in DeForest is with us. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you? How's it going today?
It's good. Are you somebody who plots your family history?
Yes, my mother and I have been doing family history now since probably the early 70s. My grandmother was doing it probably since about the early 30s, 40s. And we have eight families, well over 200 plus years in each family going back. In fact, my grandmother also has a 50-year certificate in the Historical Society, and we're looking at a 200-year in about the next 2 or 3 months.
Well, good for you guys. Are you having any problems?
One problem that I have had is that I know of information that has been listed in a book that they have in the Historical Society that we have the same family. In fact, we have various records, including birth certificates, marriage certificates, Bibles, letters. And I was wondering, how do you change that information in Historical Society in a book or something that someone has written?
Basically, once somebody has written it, it's pretty much firmly embedded. The best thing you can do is to write your own, and we'll be happy to add that to as a correction. Virtually any family history has some degree of error in it, and I've found many, many over my years of doing research, but you can't go out and change it. A lot of times you'll see misinformation available online as well, as a story from an old family history gets passed around and expanded almost exponentially. Once it's out there, you can't take it back.
And you have a lot of family histories that are in your archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
We do indeed. Yeah. We have well over 20,000 published family histories that people have done for various families all across the U.S. and Canada, and some of them are fairly obscure.
So John can submit a new one and say, this is the definitive one.
We would be happy.
Thank you, John. Margaret in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Margaret.
Hi. I have a hopefully quick question. My grandfather was born in South America around 1895. The family came to the U.S., the rumor is, through San Francisco before the earthquake. And I've tried to find information about him. He died before I was born, couldn't read or write. He couldn't. And I can't. Is there any source I could go to find records from San Francisco that could have possibly been saved from the earthquake?
Well, I don't know exactly which records survived the earthquake and which ones didn't. I wouldn't be surprised if the passenger list records did not survive, but certainly any records, for example, the 1900 census, which would have been from 6 years before the earthquake, the 1910 U.S. census, there may be a citizenship or naturalization record that has survived, all of those kinds of things, as well as records of his appearing in America after his arrival, a marriage record, a death certificate that may name parents, may give a place of origin, although it may just say a country in South America. That's always a possibility. But it's pretty much like tracing an immigrant from Europe or whatever country they may have come from.
Roxanne in Madison emails, my grandfather is fascinated by our family history. When he was an over-the-road trucker, he would stop in local historical societies to collect information about our family. He's gone to graveyards and old family homes while we were vacationing overseas, too. Now that there are websites like Ancestry.com, do people interested in genealogy do as much legwork as they used to?
I suspect they don't do quite as much legwork as they used to when so much is available online, but there is still a tremendous body of material that is not. There are records that, for various legal reasons, are not online. There are records that are just so obscure that people don't use them. I've used records at the National Archives that obviously, in Washington, that obviously hadn't been used since they were created by the agency back 100 years or more ago. Those are not online, or those particular records are not. So it's, there's a tremendous variety of things out there, and there's really no substitute for being on the premises, as it were.
Yeah. Oh, give me one last-minute pep talk here. What should I do today? I want to get started at tracing my family history. What is my assignment for today?
Write it down. Yeah. Get down in fairly organized fashion, yourself, your parents, your grandparents, and concentrate on birth, marriage, and death. Those are the three critical activities that tend to create records, and once you've got those pinned down, then you can do that the next generation, and you'll have a pretty good sense of where you can go from there.
And then sign up for one of these classes. The Wisconsin Historical Society is starting this month. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jim Hansen is a reference librarian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Quick check of our weather before our Monday morning wake-up call. It's going to be partly cloudy with a high temperature near 70 degrees today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. And it is time now for our Monday morning wake-up call. Today, our guest wants you to know how you can help the monarch butterfly. She's Donna Van Buchen, Executive Director of Wild Ones, a national environmental educational organization with a mission of educating people on the benefit of using native plants. Wild Ones recently partnered with other groups, including Monarch Watch's Bring Back the Monarch campaign in an effort to save the monarch butterfly. She joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what is the, why is the monarch butterfly in trouble?
We've been hearing for a long time about the loss of habitat down in Mexico. First of all, I should make sure that your listeners understand that the monarch butterfly is the butterfly that migrates down into Mexico every year, just like many of our birds do, go south for the winter. The monarch butterfly goes south for the winter, and the habitat down in Mexico has been being devastated over the last 20 to 50 years because of the development, just like our native lands here in the North America, in the United States, have been devastated because of development, road construction, and now we are increasing our crop production of corn and soybeans because of the ethanol. Where the monarch butterfly used to have about 23 acres that they would winter in down in Mexico, they now have only 5 acres. And so that is one of the major reasons that the loss of the monarch butterflies has been occurring. But along with that, here in north, many parts of North America where we are able to grow crops, farmers are starting to use glyphosate on their crops, or have always used glyphosate on their crops, but we have recently developed glyphosate-resistant crops, which means that farmers can spray all of their fields with corn and soybeans particularly with Roundup or some other herbicide that contains glyphosate, and it doesn't hurt those crops because they've been genetically enhanced to resist glyphosate. What this has done is allowed the farmers to expand the acreage that they have in crops, but it's also reduced the fence rows and the other weeds, so-called weeds, that grow in those crop areas. And those weeds commonly included milkweed.
And milkweed is very important for the monarch butterfly. Is that where they lay their eggs?
Yes. The milkweed is the host plant for the butterfly as it lays its eggs. It's the host plant for the caterpillar as it munches and grows. And then it also serves as a nectar plant for the adult butterflies. Not that the adult butterflies don't nectar from other plants as well, but milkweed is their preferred plant.
So you with Wild Ones are encouraging people to plant milkweed.
We are indeed. It's always been a concern of ours that we provide native plants for all of our landscaping so that we can participate in that circle of life. You know, it's not just us. It's the insects. It's the wildlife in the way of animals, mammals. It's that whole circle of life that we believe includes the native plants. Because that's how everything adapted together over the centuries of time that we've been in existence.
This time of year, would we plant milkweed right now?
Now is really not a good time to be planting plants. You can plant a plant in the fall. We would encourage you to heavily mulch it so that, like here in Wisconsin particularly, you don't have to worry about frost even this spring. Seeding, it's a little bit too early to be putting in seed. We would recommend seeding later in October or early November, or you can even seed during the winter months when it snows so that first thing in the spring the seed is able to sprout.
But I also read that you can collect milkweed seeds right now.
Yes, now is the time that you would be out collecting seed. Many people have seen the fluffy white feathery seed plants as they blow around in the air, or you can just go up to a milkweed plant and collect the seed pods. The common milkweed plant, which is the preferred plant of the butterfly for laying their eggs and for munching, has a rather large paisley-shaped cone, and inside of it is a little brown seed attached to this white, fluffy, feathery umbrella-looking material.
Well, I am going to look for the milkweed, and I'm going to plant some. Everybody loves the monarchs. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Joy. Thanks.
Donna Van Buchen, Executive Director of Wild Ones, a national environmental educational organization with a mission of educating people on the benefits of using native plants, encouraging you to plant some milkweed to help the monarch butterflies. This is the Ideas Network.